The opinions expressed in the following podcast are solely those of Jim, Joe, and their guests, and in no way reflect on any companies they work for, organizations they belong to, or casual acquaintances they meet in the hallway. They don't always get things right, but they try like hell to be honest and tell it like it is.
All right. Welcome to another Extremely Liberal podcast. Today's date is Monday, February 4th, 2013.
And, the 63rd anniversary of my parents.
Oh, cool. And I'm Jim, and we have Joe. Say hi, Joe.
Hi.
And Keith is our special guest today. Hey, Keith.
Hi, thanks for having me. Does this make me extremely liberal just by showing up?
No, not necessarily, no. You could be the one we attack.
Fair enough.
I'm going to say,
I think you're extremely liberal, but I'm pretty liberal. So, there, you know, it might be room for you to kind of jump on me.
Yeah.
All right. I'm in the same
boat. Joe, you know, has his liberal tendencies, but yeah. I think, so we're going to keep this kind of anonymous, but if we delve into some of your previous experience and just, you know, you can name drop a little if you want.
It's fine with me.
One of the first things, I'm curious about, because you're a broadcasting instructor, and is where do you get your news from? What is your media source of media these days?
I think that's a great question for lots of people, not just me, because it, you know, really speaks to what people consume. It always says something about the person individually, and also it's a changing thing. So for me, I wake up to the Today Show. I've been watching the Today Show for 25 years now,
right.
Pretty religiously in the morning, which is, you know, kind of, I think one of the reasons I like the Today Show so much is not just because of the sort of pop culture addiction aspects of it, but it's 22 minutes of broadcast news in the morning, which is very condensed. So, for example, you know, one reason I don't watch CNN in the morning so much is that it isn't really like that. It's much more, you know, lots of things.
Right.
But if it doesn't, you know, serve up, you know, a lot of news on a quick plate, mm-hmm. as much as NBC does, mm-hmm. in the morning, or and the other guys do that too. So I like that sort of what's going on, quick fix.
Right.
And then, you know, the other things include a lot of CNN.com, which I like a lot,
right.
The New Yorker, the New York Times, my local paper, the New York Times, I read both. I usually get the Sunday paper as a paper, but I read it on my phone a lot, usually in the middle of the night when I wake up. So, you know, those are some of the sources, but it's a mix of online. And I'm leaving out radio. A lot of NPR, as well as stuff on XM.
When so you commute, you listen to NPR?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, pretty multimedia variety.
Right.
Sometimes, you know, the interesting thing about CNN, because I work there, I tend, although I love their website, I tend to watch them, I think, the way a lot of people watch CNN, which is when something really big is happening,
right.
or like an election, mm-hmm. I really like watching them. But otherwise, I don't watch them that much because they don't really compel me that much. And Fox News, I will check into, but I'm not really watching Fox News for information. I'm watching Fox News to see how they distort information.
Yeah, right.
So
yeah.
You know, it's more, much more to see their
watch
dramatic
the machine
stick.
Work.
Yeah, yeah. So that's yeah. what I do.
So you worked at CNN, and I know you work for CNN.com. Is that why you like CNN.com so much?
No, not really. I mean, working for .com is just part of, you had to, as a reporter for CNN, you had to just fill all the platforms, which meant for the CNN news source, the affiliate service, for CNN International, Headline News, CNN.com, and CNN Radio. So you just, you know, that was part of your job.
What did you call it? Fill all the...
All the different platforms.
Fill all the platforms.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a term that we never would have...
Yeah, in fact, the term is, you know, it's not just a multimedia journalist, but multi-platform journalist is what the kids out there are looking for in our graduates.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, I want to get into that a little bit later because I know you've done some research on the new media and how mm-hmm. it's interacting with the old media, or the old... ways of delivering info.
But I was just going to finish the CNN.com. The reason I just think it's a good website. I think, you know, I go on there and It's not the only one I want to look at, but you know, if I'm looking for quick big picture of what's happening, it's my choice. And, if you don't mind my asking, how about you guys? What do you like to read and look at?
Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I'm an NPR junkie. I mean, it's on all the time. ABC in the morning for the popular culture fix, and then Sunday morning CBS for, you know, like the magazine type of thing.
Very artsy.
Yeah, and 60 Minutes.
60 Minutes, I left out. Yeah. I love 60 Minutes.
Yeah. And then I tab through CNN, MSNBC, and Fox for kind of the same reasons to look, not listen to the news, but listen to how the news is being.
Yeah, the take.
The take, yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The spin or whatever you want to call it.
So, how do you react to Fox News?
It's hard for me to watch. I mean, because what I think, you know, having read on the subject, and particularly this book that I bring up all the time, Whose Freedom, by George Lakoff, he's a linguist, and so he talks about politics in terms of how the language is used. And I love Fox to see the linguistic stunts, the framing, you know, telling the story from this perspective, you know, stories from a different perspective, and how language determines reality, you know, rather than kind of the other way around.
Yeah,
and that's what I like about that. I like to watch the technique.
I think I would probably add to that list of that you asked me is John Stewart, because even though John Stewart, you know, there's a big debate about whether or not that's a news source, although I think for a lot of our students it really sort of is, but lots of stuff that I might see elsewhere, and particularly with like Fox News, if you watch the way John Stewart plays with it, it adds, he's also sort of able, with humor, able to sort of really give analysis. It's a joke, but it's a serious joke,
yes,
which gives analysis that I didn't quite put together when I watched it the first time.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes. That's amazing, yeah, how he can condense down, you know, a lot of just cacophony throughout the day, and then he kind of just like boom, nails it.
Yeah, and it's juxtaposition. It's putting stuff next to each other or in sequence, and you realize, look at how it all played out.
And I think that's why, you know, so many people want to promote him to a real journalist, and he keeps saying, oh, I'm just a comedian, I'm just doing this.
I'm just an entertainer like
Rush
Limbaugh.
John, we know, because your analysis is better than any of the other people, can you not claim, you know?
Right.
And he periodically does take on Bill O'Reilly and does those debates and stuff with Bill O'Reilly, which are always, you know, fun, because they seem to, you know, it's one thing that Bill O'Reilly must really like him personally, because they, you know, he keeps letting John abuse him. But my list of what I consume as far as media goes, you know, it depends on the day of the week. On the weekends, it's slightly different. But I used to watch the Today Show when I was growing up, and my parents watched the Today Show. Mm-hmm. And so whenever I lived in their house, that was the, you know, news source. But over the years, I've backed away from those, you know, Good Morning America, Today shows, because there's just too much soft news for me.
That's true.
And it's
a lot of fluff.
Pop culture.
Yeah. And the personalities change, and some I like, some I didn't, you know. So I kind of backed away from it. I mean, when Bryant Gumbel and Jane Pauley were on there is when I was watching.
Right,
every
so
morning.
80s. Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, and but yeah, I kind of backed away. You know, maybe not consciously, but I just kind of stopped watching that either because I was, you know, getting up and surfing the web or doing something, you know, where, you know, I was, you know, my mornings were spent doing something different. But today, what I wake up and watch CNN, and, you know, if they're doing a lot of fluff, I might just flip around the channel and find something non-news related to
watch.
Although
in the morning they're trying to be harder.
Yeah, and I want to talk a little bit about the changes at CNN, because you know there's some big changes coming. I don't know how much you've tracked on that, but so anyways, I wake up in CNN and then I get on Twitter immediately. And Twitter, to me, which I don't think you're on Twitter yet, right?
I am on Twitter, but I don't tweet a lot.
You just don't do it, yeah. You know, and I resisted it for a long time. And I remember feeling kind of resentful of some of the blogs that I was reading. And it kind of seemed like they were spending more time on Twitter than writing for their blog. I remember being kind of resentful of Twitter because it's like, well, come on, you're not writing because you're out playing around on Twitter. You know? Mm-hmm. So it is kind of a time waster for some people.
But, that's true.
So I resisted Twitter just because I thought, you know, I don't need another social media thing that's going to take my time away from me.
That's my fear.
Yeah. And once I kind of dove into it, and for one thing, it was a great way to promote my blog. And my traffic on my blog like quadrupled within 2 weeks of going on Twitter. And that's because of, you know, you share a link and then those people share the link. And, you know, and of course, you know, as you build more followers, it just kind of, you know, exponentially it grows. So I saw the benefit of it for, you know, my own promotion of the blog. But then the other thing is, it's a great source of news, because if you follow good people who tweet good stories, like links to, you know, whatever the subject of the day is, it's kind of like they're your filter for you.
Right.
You don't have to go looking and weeding through all the crap to find the stuff you want. Mm-hmm. If you have trusted people that you follow that, you know, tweet out something and they say must read or, you know, check this out or whatever, if they
add content. Also gives you more variety into, I mean, depending on what you choose for followers, it gives you access to things that you otherwise probably wouldn't see.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, it's, I mean, I've discovered, you know, blogs or publications that I never really read that much, but after seeing a couple of links and going, wow, maybe I need to, you know, check them out and put them on, add them to my bookmarks. And so, I mean, it's opened up my eyes to a lot of things that I didn't know. But so, I mean, Twitter to me is a great source of news in that way too. It's not just people being snarky and, you know, calling each other names or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then at 9 o'clock, I switch over to Chuck Todd's show.
The Daily Rundown.
And,
yeah.
And Chuck and I have, you know, exchanged tweets before. Mm-hmm. We don't always agree. And I think he's one of the worst offenders of the both sides do it mentality.
Uh-huh. You see that he's too equivocal.
Yeah.
And then that actually ends up distorting the, right. the big picture,
like,
in your view.
And like Thomas Mann and E.J. Dionne wrote that book, which I'm drawing a blank on the name of it, but basically saying, calling out the media and saying, It isn't both sides. And if you keep saying it's both sides, the Republicans are going to keep getting away with it. It's mm-hmm. the Republicans that are primarily distorting things. And they need to be called out on it. Or, you know, and we can't, well, you know, they both sides do it, but this side does it 90% of the time and this side does it 10. And for the media just to blanket and say both sides is a disservice to their viewers.
The appearance of balance is imbalance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I mean, I call out Chuck Todd occasionally on that kind of stuff.
Is he gracious when you do that, or?
Yeah, he actually is. I mean, he, you know, like around Christmas time, I tweeted him a, you know, happy holidays thing or something, and he responded and basically said, you know, same to your family, and, you know, and then there was a little exchange and it was kind of like, you know, and thanks for not blocking me. You know, it was kind of one of those things, because, and he goes, well, I don't block anybody unless they get personal.
Yeah.
They talk about my family. You know, people can have differing opinions.
Right.
And I'm not going to block him, which I really respect him, because he does let people who criticize him continue to criticize him, and he doesn't just block them and lock them
out.
He's
in a role which is unusual. I mean, I think what happened with Chuck Todd was that Meet the Presses, help me out, I'm blanking out, he died.
David Gregory? Tim Russer.
Tim Russer, yeah. Tim Russer died. That not only elevated David Gregory, but it also elevated Chuck Todd, because he was the political director. He was also very good on air, but they were looking for more people who could have the gravitas and analysis that Tim Russert had. Mm-hmm. And so when Chuck Todd is on the air, you're often looking for him not just to report, but to sort of give the ultimate meaning of you know what you just saw.
Right.
So, like when, for example, just you know, a week and a half ago, when Hillary and Obama went on 60 Minutes, you know, the question that goes to Chuck Todd is, okay, so you know, what are we supposed to make of that?
Yeah.
He says, well, it's you know, it was mostly that it was a thank you. It falls more in the thank you column.
Right.
But he said, but the image of them sitting together, it's hard not to for people to interpret that as some sort of endorsement.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, I think you're dead on as far as, and that's I think where he falls into that both sides trap, because he's got to be the above it all, both parties analyst type role. And if he were to, you know, focus on the Republicans to the extent they deserve it, people would claim he was biased, you know. So there's this fighting back against the perception of bias.
Yeah, I mean, it makes it harder for him or for Andrea Mitchell because they're on MSNBC, so they are their main role is to be nonpartisan, but they have shows on a left-leaning channel.
Mm-hmm. So kind of continuing that, so, you know, I watch Chuck Todd at 9, but then I read, you know, one of my main blogs is the Maddow blog, where Steve Bannon is the main blogger, and he's my, you know, hero. I've mentioned it. I think every podcast I've talked about Steve Bannon, but, you know, for me, he's the best there is. And Rachel Maddow realized that and stole him away from the Washington Monthly. He used to be the blogger there, and Rachel Maddow basically made him an offer. And prior to making him an offer, she had mentioned him on her air about he's the best blogger there is, and the, you know, and so Rachel and I agree that Steve is the best, and and part of it is because he's snarky, and he, you know, he's kind of like a Jon Stewart in that he can distill things down to, you know, the point, and you know, and
if you can remember, what would be one of the best examples of that?
I don't know. I was think I was looking at his site just a second ago, and well, like, you know, this extortion politics that cannot stand. You know, him and Rachel, I think, have been doing, you know, a great job of keeping the spotlight on the Republicans' obstructionism. You know, it's a story that, you know, you could run with for a little while and then just kind of ignore, and then it keeps on going, you know. Maybe people get, you know, desensitized to a certain story, and even though the atrocity keeps on going, the media's moved on to other stories,
right.
You know, and they keep focusing back on this because it continues to happen. It isn't something.
It doesn't sell that well as a story.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, as an individual story.
Right.
Or, yeah.
Well, Rachel frequently was just like, nobody else is talking about this. You can tell she's frustrated because she sees the importance of it, but, you know, but the rest of the media isn't. So, you know, I see she kind of shames them in a way. And so, anyways, the changes at CNN. Well, let's back up a little bit and talk about your experience at CNN and what kind of insights do you have about just, you know, I don't watch a lot of CNN, but I know a lot of my Twitter followers think they're biased and that they have a Tea Party bias. They tend to bring on the Tea Party people perspective more than any of the others, maybe even more than Fox in some people's minds. But what do you think about, you know, do you see a bias at CNN now that you're away from it, or did you when you were there?
Yeah, I mean, so this is a big enchilada question that you've asked me, and I'll do the best I can with it. What's happening recently with CNN, you may actually know a lot more about it, some of it than I do, because you're a better viewer than I am. So let me just try to, you know, answer what I think I can handle. So I worked at CNN from 1997 to the very beginning of 2008. And most of the time I worked for the affiliate service, which is reporters who travel around the U.S. and sometimes internationally to do live shots for the network and headline news and stuff, but mostly for local stations. So, you know, if, you know, I was on just, you know, about every TV affiliate that did news in the U.S. So that's where my main work went. And then the latter half, I was just a general correspondent for CNN Chicago. You know, one of the things that, you know, we look at in one of my classes is big media. And, you know, you realize how that there are about six companies that own the lion's share of the world's media. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking about, you know, Disney and Comcast and Time Warner. They own a lot of the film companies, publishing, television shows, production companies. You know, if I try to sort of tell students, when you go into see a movie and you look at Village Road shows or you see the production company name that precedes the film, lots of times that's part of another company. So right. Time Warner is Warner Brothers that makes Harry Potter, as well as CNN, right. as well as People Magazine.
Right, yeah.
So if the question of bias in general, I think, is it's always there. And one way that you can look at bias is that we have an American bias. You know, we care about stuff, but we don't really care that much about what happens in India. So if, you know, a lot of people die in India, but, you know, that little boy in that bunker, mm-hmm. you know, doesn't make it. You know, we're going to care a lot more about that
one boy
than we are about. So there are sort of, you know, biases that have maybe a certain regional reason to them. Other biases are sort of clear in that Fox is right wing, even though they don't sell themselves that way. But other biases are more, you know, harder to pinpoint. I think that the big bias is that you're working for a company. It's a business. And so what makes news is often satisfying the whims or general desires of that money-making business. Mm-hmm. That's the model of journalism that we have, is that the people who give us information, with some exception like NPR, or at least, you know, government-supported or viewer-supported outlets, most of it is based on the idea that the company that is giving you information for a democracy is also a company that makes money doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that model, while, you know, like democracy, the worst of the best of bad alternatives, it's always flawed, you know, because it tends to push you to towards sensationalism. It pushes you towards something that's going to get a lot of readers. Yeah. It's not a model that often leads to depth. Surprisingly, sometimes it's been a model that, you know, has really uncovered really great stuff.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the stuff that we are all referring to are money-making journalism operations mm-hmm. that, you know, need to make a buck and also can, you know, do a good job at telling the truth. But it can add to a whole lot of noise and all kinds of bias all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when I worked at CNN, I was part of that system.
Mm-hmm.
Let me also say, I really liked working for CNN. It was a fun job.
Right.
I got to go do cool stories.
Yeah, I often judge a job as when you feel that you have the resources that you need to do your work.
Yeah, I thought I did.
Yeah,
I thought there were a lot of talented people, a lot of people who I think not only were there and are there who really care, but they're also part of a system that's problematic. It's both. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, to sort of, when people say, is CNN biased, or is CBS or NBC, ABC biased, things like that, it's not sort of a, you know, yes or no answer.
Right.
It tends to be a set of factors in which part of it might very well be, but a lot of it has to do with corporate ownership.
Right. Well, I guess I... You know, as you were talking, I was thinking how, you know, Fox News, I think, you know, memos have been leaked of do not speak about this or use this term when you refer to the, you know, there have been some internal memos leaked from Fox that shows that they are giving, like, talking points.
Yeah, and all you have to do is, you know, watch it for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
They'll
you know, they hand it off to the next anchor, and that anchor says the same thing, you know. So they clearly have coordinated. But I don't perceive CNN or MSNBC as having that kind of bias, where they're given a memo and they're told this
No. I mean, although there might have, you know, one of the things, you know, we were... studying last week in one of my classes was how did the media en masse make such a huge mistake in the information before the Iraq war? I mean, there was, we know now that there were no weapons of mass destruction. There was no link between al-Qaeda, but a very, kind of good at strong-arming administration. The George W. Bush administration did a kind of great job of, from their point of view, controlling the media. The media was a bunch of sheepdogs. But then, things changed, and the media got tougher, and the administration fell apart eventually.
Yeah.
But it was a period where the media were really afraid, and they were really not as much afraid of the Bush administration as they were afraid of the audience. They were afraid that people were going to turn them off if they weren't right. Sounding patriotic.
Oh, sure, yeah. So, and you were working for CNN at that time,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. And, in that documentary, that they have an interview with Walter Isaacson, who was then the president, and, the implication was that people just sort of knew not to push too hard. Mm-hmm. Bob Simon is in the same doc, and he says the same thing. People knew to kind of be careful. And not
just because the backlash of unpatriot, being called unpatriotic or something.
Yeah, because you're working for a company, and that company has got stockholders, and they don't want to.
Sure.
So, I mean, to be honest with you, I can't really recall, moments where I was not reporting something because I was fearful.
Yeah.
But the truth is, as a reporter, you're always trying to sort of balance, make sure you got both sides in there.
Mm-hmm.
But in retrospect, does it seem fair to accuse CNN of being biased, or a lot of media being biased, or just scared shitless? Yes.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty fair.
I guess, and as you were talking, the way I think that, networks can do it is by who they hire. And which anchors, for example, CNN is, whether it's a rumor or not, but Aaron Burnett is supposed to be moving to the mornings on CNN.
Oh, really? Okay.
And I'm not sure.
So that would replace Soledad? Or
that's what I'm not sure. Is she going to come on after Soledad? But
yeah.
One article I read was, which was kind of a tangent in a way, but that it was saying that there was some quote from some executive at CNN that said Soledad's show was appealing to too many minorities, and that they needed to appeal to everybody, not
they need
just
to white. The implication being they need to white
it out. And apparently he came right out and said it, and it kind of floored everybody because
who said that?
I could go.
Okay, that's
it. It was somebody at CNN, and
on the inside.
On the inside. And it was heard by enough people that internally at CNN, people were kind of taken aback.
Uh-huh. I think I could see how they would be taken
aback. Because it was, maybe demographically it was true that we need to appeal to a broader audience, but just the way he said it was kind of offensive to a lot of people.
Sure.
But it looks like, and Aaron Burnett, who I haven't watched her evening show, but I used to watch MSNBC, Morning Joe, until I realized that that was part of my blood pressure problem.
Joe Scarborough was driving you crazy,
right? Yeah, he was. My health's been much better since I stopped watching that. But she used to be on there in the mornings, and she's a Wall Street person. She's a representative of big business, but I hear a lot of criticism of her on her new show, and I've seen it
as being left or right or what,
as being pro business,
and
kind of buying into the business idea that Obama's anti business, and just kind of she's on that side of Wall Street in a way, and then she's kind of delved into some politics too that she's kind of shown a slight bias, but then like John King is one person that. I was watching, he had a Tea Party person on, mm-hmm. and no person to counterbalance the Tea Party person. And the Tea Party person was just spewing out things that were provably wrong, mm-hmm. that had been debunked either by CNN itself or other news, you know.
But he was not properly challenged.
And John King just let them put it out there and then moved on to the next question, then moved on. And it was almost like he's not, you know, and I know John King isn't stupid. And he knew that what they were saying was not true and was something that had been debunked, yet he just let them put it out there, moved on to the next question. And, there wasn't any challenge at all. It was kind of like, here, I'm throwing you a softball, now hit this one. Now I'm going to throw you another softball. So I see, you know, and other people have pointed out John King's bias, too. So,
the media is gotten messier and messier. One of the things, you know, we're talking about with Jon Stewart is how, you know, the Fairness Doctrine ended in the late 80s. Mm-hmm. So it used to be that the part of the, from the 40s on, because of all these, you know, radio demagogues that used to be out there, including our Michigan's own Father Coughlin, the FCC developed regulations which said to broadcasters, if you've got to represent both sides, you have to have, you know, point, counterpoint. And, you know, so this period of that we sort of maybe over-idealized, but it's, you know, from Murrow to through Cronkite, you know, that's sort of where we sort of see as TV journalism as being more balanced. Then the late 80s, the Fairness Doctrine is abolished. It's abolished largely because of, you know, the Reagan years were very deregulatory. There were some liberals that wanted it to go away, but mostly it was a Republican-conservative thing. And that really helped talk radio, which was already moving right, and it helped Fox News be what it is.
Right.
So now the expectation is not that John King is going to talk to that Tea Party guy and you're going to get a balance, but it's just going to be what it is.
Yeah.
And you know, I think you're, you know, very fair in criticizing John King that he can still challenge this interviewee.
Yeah.
But there is still there's no more of an expectation that when you hear the a partisan position that it's going to be counterbalanced by another side.
Yeah.
So so viewers have to figure it out.
Yeah.
You have to just, you know, hear all this stuff and figure out, okay, what's truth and what's not. Right. And how are you supposed to do that?
Yeah. I think, you know, a good illustration of that, and Joe and I talked about it on a previous podcast, was Soledad, and I have gone around quite a few times on Twitter, and she had Grover Norquist on. And I tweeted something like, you know, giving him a platform to, you know, spread his ideas.
Anti-tax stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and the thing I have about Grover Norquist, he's been saying the same thing for 30 years.
Uh-huh.
The exact same freaking words about, you know, the job creators and blah, blah, blah. You know, just the whole rap.
My favorite is the tax burden.
Yeah.
In other words, there is no tax that is not a burden.
Right, yeah. So anyways, I challenged her and I said, you know, basically giving this guy a platform and you know.
Did she not challenge him in your view? She just let him spew?
No, she did a lot better job than, you know, in challenging him, but he filibusters. I mean, he kept going and, you know, he's like, and she tried to interrupt and he just keep going, you know, talk over her and, you know, he got his message out. That's
right,
for sure.
Right.
But her response to me on Twitter was, well, you know, he represents a certain segment of people and, so, he, you know, his opinion is valid because, you know, there's people that
see the world the way he sees it.
And so, I mean, the idea that, you know, well, we've got to give a platform for his views too. Well, you know, child molesters, there's a certain segment of our child molesters are, I mean, not to use that as a prime example, but why does it that we have to give every fringe group a platform now?
Well, I mean, I'm going to defend her a little bit. I mean, you know, I think that given the playing field is the way it is, that even though I think the interviewer should challenge, you can't expect, in at least in a, you know, 3-minute conversation, if it goes even that long, to for you to be fighting over every point. You got to kind of, you know, there has to be a lot of just let it go and let them make their point and move on, because that's that's the format that now exists. So she's sort of saying, in response to your comments, that he's, even though he's fringe to you, he's not fringe to
right.
a lot of other people. Mm-hmm. And I can't be, you know, sniping at everything he says. I can challenge him a bit, but right. not the whole time. You were going to say something?
Yeah, no, you could. I see very well how that works, where if you stopped at every untruth, it wouldn't be an interview.
It would be a battle.
Soledad has done that, like with John Sununu, who we've talked about before, where he was trying to bring up the $716 billion, you know, meme that was during the campaign, and she just kept challenging John Sununu, wouldn't let up.
Yeah,
and you know, and
she's
so,
tougher.
Yeah, she's done a great
and
job.
And now maybe she's going to get
and now
the sideline.
She's I know, which you know
for the second time, which, if that's true,
which is a buy to me. Chris Cuomo is just
on ABC.
He's moving over to CNN.
Uh huh.
And he's supposed to be doing the mornings, I think, with Aaron.
Okay.
So maybe they're gonna, you know, maybe they're not. You know, part of this article where they talked about her appealing to too many minorities was also about how they had that panel that they created similar to Morning Joe. So they're, in a way, they were trying to go for that kind of format where they had, you know, talking heads around a table and that they all the issues were kind of thrown around the group, right? Well, that's the way Soledad's current show was. You know, the whole show was like that. Well, then they cut back that back to just the 8 to 9 hour. So they, you know, so over the last 6 months, 8 months, they've actually changed Soledad's show and shortened the amount of time they had this group. And now it sounds like they're going to get rid of her altogether. So maybe they're going to do more of a soft show like Today or something on CNN. I don't know what the what.
Yeah, here's the weird thing in terms of. You know, the big picture on our conversation. So, you know, in terms of people who watch an evening newscast, if you add it up just between ABC, NBC, and CBS, those, the big three broadcast networks, that's like, you know, still pretty healthy. It's like around 25 million people, mm-hmm. maybe up to 30, you know, in that range. So, you know, in the range of 6 to 9 per evening newscast. CNN on a kind of normal night is generally like around 500,000 for one of its better shows, for Piers Morgan. Maybe up to 8, maybe down to mm-hmm. 4. A lot of their shows are getting around somewhere between 200,000 to 250,000 viewers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's like what, you know, medium or, no, actually not bigger than medium, local TV gets in
right.
in top 20 markets. So this is, you know, CNN gets a lot of attention because it is expansive in all kinds of ways. It goes to a lot of places.
Right.
But its viewership is really low.
Relatively.
And Fox, you know, with O'Reilly at least, can get, you know, between 1 and 3 million a night. So they are heftier. But still, cable news in general is like, you know,
yeah.
little audiences.
Mm-hmm.
And but, you know, along comes a new head of CNN now, Jeff Zucker.
Mm-hmm.
He's got these ratings problems, even though CNN makes money in a lot of ways.
Right.
And he's got to do something,
yeah.
at least in his head he does.
Yeah.
And so Soledad may not be, the ratings may not go up any higher than they are now with Soledad after this change. And she may not have made that much of a difference from when it was Kieran Chetry and John Roberts.
Right.
But the new guy coming in has got to, you know, make changes, and sometimes it's that's what it is.
You think it's going to go more towards entertainment programming? Because I saw Anthony Bourdain has a show coming on CNN, and he's the guy who travels around and tries food in all the exotic mm-hmm. places and stuff. And he's kind of a rebel. He's kind of a, you know,
wild guy.
Yeah, he's, you know, drunk frequently on his show because he's sampling the wines of the area and stuff, and he talks about doing peyote. And I mean, he's.
So is he? They're talking about having a show on Headline News or HLN or anything like that.
CNN. It's going to be CNN. CNN show that similar to what he's done for the Travel Network and
Travel Food
as well. He started out on the Food Network. I don't know if, you know, I've been seeing ads for it coming, but I don't think it's actually premiered yet.
That's a great question. I'm not sure. I mean, to some extent, you know, what used to be Headline News, now HLN, is, you know, a lot of crap. And it was sort of, you know,
all Nancy Grace all the time.
Right.
Just, right.
Oh, make it stop.
But there's also Drew Pinsky.
Yeah.
You know, it's all sort of, you know, medical, legal, personality driven stuff.
Yeah.
And whether they're left or right.
What's her name? Arias, the trial of the person who killed her boyfriend. It's just, it's constant.
Yeah. Yeah, Nancy Grace has taken over HLN.
Jane Velez Mitchell. Is that
what? Well, they're all covering that trial.
Yeah,
the Arias trial.
Right.
So it used to be Headline News, like these are the 15 top stories, and covering a little bit of them.
Very and formatted, now, yeah. Fairly repetitive, but it was always
there. It was headline news.
But you could tune in
headline.
At any point and get all the stories.
Right.
Right.
And now it's this
condensed
thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, but that's, you know, that's making more money. So yeah. Maybe that has answered your question, which is, you know, yes, it is going to become,
well,
it is becoming more interesting.
I think it raised a good point, you know, as far as the ratings of these cable networks go. Is their influence outsized compared to the influence they actually have? You know, I mean, because, you know, like something I frequently do on Twitter with people that get all upset about, you know, either somebody on MSNBC saying, you know, something negative to the president, and they get all upset about it, you know, and I'm frequently going, yeah, but how many people are watching this show? And is it, you know, everybody's kind of centric to whatever their medium is, and they think everybody's seeing this story, whereas it's like one moment in one hour that, you know, is disposable, but they get all worked up about, you know, something.
Well,
that
I think it goes in different directions. So, you know, on the one hand, these are small audiences, and just like you're pointing out now, that these are sort of, you know, a group of obsessed people like you, okay, who are, you know, oh my God, you know, and so it sort of seems maybe larger than it is. But on the other hand, you know, media has a way of, as we're also suggesting, of sometimes being larger than a small audience that it's measured to be.
Mm-hmm.
So if the ratings are low, for example, for some of these shows, well, you know, it also sort of spills out into other online and
YouTube
and Twitter media. It gets replayed. It gets on Jon Stewart's show. So once it's out there, it can carry. But the the media itself has a way of creating attention beyond those who are just watching in the moment. Mm-hmm. CNN has, you know, one of the things that they always said to us when I was there was one of the problems that we have is that people watch us for 5 minutes or 10 minutes, but they don't stay with us. Bill O'Reilly, they stay with. So we need to be, you know, we need to get people to watch for longer. Right. I don't think they've really had been effective at changing that, but if people are only watching for like 5 minutes, they may not get rated. In other words, the numbers might be a lot higher. Like, for example, have you ever been to Metro Airport in Detroit?
Yeah.
Well, there's tons of CNN screens all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's you know, rampant. But I'm not sure that, A, that's getting measured, or B, even if you did measure it, how can you?
Right.
You know, because there's just people.
Well, look up and CNN, to me, I respect because they're international. They're everywhere.
That's
you
right.
Know?
That's
and
right.
They've got reporters everywhere. And so if you want to, you know, certainly international news, you're going to get probably a more accurate report out of CNN because they've got somebody who's been on the ground living in that city or whatever. And whereas, you know, MSNBC, I don't think even tries to do international. And Fox, I don't
think. Fox is a national network, and MSNBC and NBC as a company is more nationally based in that part of it. But, you know, it is an international company.
So tell us, did you ever meet Wolf Blitzer?
Yeah, I did. I've met most of the folks who are there, and so I have opinions about everybody.
Yeah, and I mean another podcast. I
listen to. Guy, very nice guy.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
Here's the thing: before I say anything, you know, I regret what you're going to make me say.
I put a disclaimer on the front end.
You know, people who are in TV news more often than not are kind of egotistical. I mean, that sort of comes with the base. But I will say this is that. You know, whether or not I thought somebody was good and I liked them had almost no relation to each other. In other words, I saw some people, they were really excellent, but then think they were really good at their jobs.
Yeah.
And then I thought people who were excellent and really great, and then I thought people who were jerks, you know, both that they were not good and also really good.
Yeah.
And there was no correlation between those factors.
Yeah.
He happened to be someone who, at least, I didn't know him that, you know, well, but I interacted with him a little bit, who I thought, you know, he seemed like a very, very personable guy.
Yeah, Ches Pazienza, who I think I've asked you about before, he worked at CNN, but he does a podcast with Bob Suska, and he frequently talks about the personalities, and like Carol Costello, he was a producer of her show for a while, and just thinks Carol's the greatest thing. Oh, she's so nice, and what he said about Wolf was he's like the hardest working man in show business.
I think that's true.
He works
really hard.
He works his butt off all the time.
Right.
And, you know, he'll be on air 14 hours a day and not miss a beat, you know.
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, the same thing. You know, it's like Ches, you know, I'm trying to think of who is a guy that got fired from CNN. He said something about Jewish
Rick.
Rick Sanchez.
Sanchez.
And just says Rick Sanchez was just like one of the best broadcasters. I mean, he was a pro. I mean, he knew how to deliver a line and all that.
He was really good. He was really smart. His ego was out of control.
Yeah, he said his ego was just incredible. Yeah.
Right. And, you know,
I always wonder, do they become that way to keep their job, or were they that way and that's why they gravitated?
More the latter, I think.
Being a broadcasting instructor, are your students come in with egos?
Sometimes, Look, you know, there's nothing wrong about with a student having some ego or vanity to try to go
into
this.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to, you know, tell the student, like, you know, stop, you know, kissing yourself in the mirror, because it's not going to do anything anyway. You know, if they are, they are. Here's the thing: is that in order to make it, you've got to not only, you know, be working all these multimedia things, but you've got to push. You've got to work really hard. Mm-hmm. So if somebody is vain and they don't try very hard, well, then they're not going to make it.
Yeah.
But if somebody, whether they're vain or they're nice, they're going to have to work hard in order to be successful.
Absolutely.
So,
how are we doing on time, Joe?
We are at 47.
Okay, cool. Kind of going along with that, what do you think about like MSNBC hiring the Reverend Al and even Martin Bashir and some of these people that aren't really broadcast journalists, but they've been kind of put in a role of a broad, like, you know, I hear a lot of criticism of Reverend Al because he, you know, he has trouble speaking sometimes, he stumbles, he isn't, you know, when he's reading a teleprompter, he's not really that polished.
He's Reverend Al.
But I'll tell you what, Reverend Al, during the 2008 campaign, 2004 campaign, I kept going, he's the one saying it like it is. When, you know, when somebody would beat around the bush about George W. Bush or whatever, Reverend Al would come on just like boom, and I go, thanks, Al. You know,
right.
So I mean, he, you know, I like his opinion, but what do you think about people who are more celebrities getting roles as journalists?
Right. Well, I have mixed feelings about it. I mean, at CNN, I felt that there was a double standard between people who were in the prime time slots who were not journalists and they were, you know, show hosts, you know, with, you know, obviously with the purpose of getting ratings, like, you know, Nancy Grace being one of them, and you would have to go on that show and, you know, you were used to a certain set of standards by which you behaved, and then, you know, Nancy Grace is yelling at you. And so, I thought that was a real kind of mix of identities. And I think with MSNBC, now, Al Sharpton is a good person to talk about because he surprised me. I mean, I used to really feel that he was more problematic than I started to feel about him maybe from maybe 2008 on. You know, he actually can be a real voice of sanity sometimes and really make great points. That what I feel more uncomfortable about with him now is not his opinions, but that he's holding rallies. He's an activist. Yeah. It's not just that he's a show host with an opinion. He's an activist out there trying to make something occur, and also trying to impart information in his show host role. So, you know,
he's gotten a lot of criticism recently.
Yeah, and I get uncomfortable with someone who is not just using the bully pulpit, but also sort of out there on the street organizing. Then it becomes so hard to distinguish between opinion makers and people who are actively organizing things to make things happen. Mm-hmm. So,
and kind of going along with that, what do you think about journalists who say, "I don't vote because I need to stay nonpartisan"? Is that kind of an ego thing?
Well, I mean, CNN had a policy which said I can't put a lawn sign out for my house. And, I don't think that's legal to say that, you can't, express your opinion. Mm-hmm. But, I kind of understood where they were coming from. And, I think the idea of journalists walking around with, if you're from flag pins to, vote for Romney or Obama, that's doesn't go with your job.
Right.
But at the same time, I mean, do we really want to get the news from somebody who's not voting?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, go vote. You don't have to be.
You don't have to talk about it.
No, but you need to be taking part in democracy.
Well, it's almost like I'm going to pretend like I don't have an opinion because, if they're involved in the news, they clearly have an opinion, right?
Yeah, that means you're more informed.
If you're paying attention and you have a brain that thinks, then most everybody would. So, I think, it's kind of a front they put up, like, I'm really nonpartisan because I don't vote. But, when I talk to my wife, I'm going to tell her like I really feel, Mm-hmm. Like Keith Olbermann, I think, is one who said he
would
doesn't
do that.
Vote.
Yeah, and he was so full of Keith Olbermann.
Yeah. It's funny that, how Keith Olbermann, offended not just Republicans, but, Democrats and liberals and the left, too, because of, his ego for the most part, But,
I think one of the things that, I'm really interested in watching with my students is what happens with Al Jazeera English.
Because I find that fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, there's been some, I think Al Jazeera English is, it's complicated, or Al Jazeera in general. I think there has been not just sort of a point of view that's a different country's point of view or a different cultural point of view, but also there's been, inflammatory stuff on Al Jazeera in Arabic that's been arguably anti-Semitic. It's the network that's willing to put body count and provocative because of its audience. It's trying to reach the Arab street. But on the other hand, they were the first network to interview Israeli officials, to put Hebrew on their network. They went after the Arab Spring and were hard hitting in ways that we were not. They put out information that we don't.
Yeah.
So it's more gray than black and white, right. But cable companies have not wanted Al Jazeera because they're afraid of the perception of that. And now
they need to come up with a warm and fuzzy name, instead of Al Jazeera.
Yeah, well,
Bob,
that's right.
Patriot TV.
It's a little like Barack Hussein Obama. Right. Arab words scare people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's funny how Al Gore was the one who sold Current to them. You go, hey, now, and he's getting a lot of flack for selling out and how much he's worth more than Mitt Romney is, and
he made $100 million. Yeah. The whole thing, the deal was $500, and he made like $100 supposedly. Yeah. So that's a pretty good change.
Well, my goal, and I mentioned this to Joe before, is to start my own cable network.
And, what are you going
to
call it?
The Truth.
Oh, nice. That's good.
And I want to go back to the fairness doctrine and bring on balanced, you know, try to have balanced points of view. And even Joe was talking about, you know, hearing an interview from a British journalist and how they just hammer people. It's just like, no, wait a second, you didn't answer my question. You know, they're real confrontational.
Maybe if you call it The Truth, you could get Jack Nicholson to do promos, which is,
yeah,
you can't handle the truth.
The truth. Yeah. Or I could just lift that line from Few Good Men and Use, right? Then get sued, right? But no, I mean, I long for the days of Walter Cronkite and Edward R. Murrow, and where, you know, or even All the President's Men, you know, where they have to get confirmation.
And they dug.
Have to, you know, you can't just throw innuendo out there. And it seems like in today's, you know, news media, they'll just run with a story. I mean, I think of the Balloon Boy, you know, as the perfect example of the cable news media. Hey, there's a balloon and it's got a kid in it. It's floating. You go, oh my God, we're tracking the balloon across the country and there's a little kid in it. You know, I'm just like, you fell for this, you know?
Yeah.
Right. Did you not realize who these people were, that they were on a reality show and that they're attention grabbers?
Or
Man Titanium. History?
Man Titanium.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Oh my God. That's just beyond me. And then the legs that it had, even after the so-called truth was known.
It's still going.
I know. It's... This is not news. This is not anything.
Right.
Well,
although
I mean, you could say that it shouldn't be news, but it was news by the standards of stuff, not only that was carried, but that stuff that people ended up talking about.
Right.
You bring it up in one of your classes, and do kids start to, you know, really pick up when you bring up the subject of Matt Titeo? Yeah, they did.
Yeah, because they're interested in it.
Yeah.
Because it's like, he got punked.
I guess it's news about the nature of of social media, which, you know, that's a story.
Yeah.
Let's say you were a reporter, okay, and you're covering the Matt Titeo story, and, you know, you get part, some of the information that you get is from within your network or AP, you know, places that you rely upon, which, you know, you might say the AP is reporting, you might attribute it, or you might not to, because your company pays for that service where you can use it, right? So do you think in your story that you're going to be, at the end of the day, good enough to say, is this girlfriend real? You know, I mean, I kind of think that at the end of the day, if I was the ESPN reporter who made the mistake, that I'd make the same damn mistake, that I would be duped, because I wouldn't be sharp enough to think that the girlfriend didn't exist.
Ask that question. Yeah.
So I can sort of see why they screwed up.
Oh, yeah.
You know, as soon as the story broke, I thought, now, if I was writing about this, what would I have done first? And the first thing I would have done was to try to find an obituary for this girl, just to find out a little background, how old she was, whatever, you know. The first thing I would Google would be to try to find an obituary for this girl.
Of course, at the time that it became a big story, that obit probably wouldn't have been out yet, so would it have to have been a little bit...
Right. Did the story break while she was still alive, or...
Well, didn't she die, and the grandmother's, you know...
She never died.
She never died. Thanks. Thank you. Didn't she live? No, she didn't do that either.
I sent a card.
it was on the right around the big game day that she quote unquote died along with his grandmother,
right?
So, but you're making a great point. But the point that the story sort of got carried,
yeah.
Hope it might not
have
been out yet.
You know, the journalists, and you, I mean, tell me how much they do this, but if somebody writes a story and then somebody else kind of uses that as
a basis
for their story, do they just assume that the guy who wrote the original story did his homework? Or
that's the essential question right there. So, you know, media begets media, and so stories grow because of that. Now, if it's within your own company and it's, you know, someone who's reporting from the inside, or a news source that you pay for that you trust, that might be within the range of understandably, you know, yeah, you've trusted it and that makes sense. If it's, you're just reading a lot and a lot of other sources, no, you're not supposed to necessarily trust it, and you should be attributing to it. But the truth is, it sort of creates a general sense of belief that does affect all media, and that's what happened in this case.
Yeah, which is real fascinating because, you know, there are some bloggers who put a lot of links, you know, that's like, this is the source of this, you know, and I tend to do that myself. I mean, if I'm going to put out, you know, certainly if I'm going to borrow an idea from somebody, I'm going to give them as the source. I'm going to give them credit,
right?
And then I'm going to provide the link. So if you want to go to that link and see yourself what the source of that comment
right. Although arguably, you know, anytime you attribute someone, you're still hanging your hat on the truth of what that person's reporting.
Sure. Yeah.
So attribution, although it sort of, you know, kind of says, you know, this is, I'm not the original source on it, you are recommending that as information.
Yeah. And so you have some responsibility for that.
Right.
I mean, I've had people say, you know, send me emails or whatever and say, you know, what was the source of that? And it's like, well, I put the link and, you know, that person was the source, so they bear some of the responsibility.
But you also, when you do that, your thought process is, you know, this seems like a good source to me.
Well, yeah, I don't use bad sources. You know, I try not to. And if it's somebody I've never heard of or whatever, then the way if I quote them, I'll just say, you know, I thought this was interesting. You know, I don't know. Sometimes I'll qualify it because, you know, if I don't know the source. But the other interesting thing that I think blogging in particular opens up, I've been a fierce critic of Glenn Greenwald. Do you know who he is?
I don't, no.
I'm glad.
Yeah.
Because he should be unknown. But he used to write for Salon.com.
Okay.
And he calls himself a civil libertarian.
Uh-huh.
But he's been one of the fiercest critics of the Obama administration and the drone policy.
Where does he write now?
Bradley meant The Guardian.
Okay.
He writes for The Guardian.
So for he's American who writes for the Brits, or he's
well, he's American. He lives in Brazil.
Uh-huh.
Because his partner can't get a visa or something to come to him. So he lives in Brazil, writes for The Guardian now. But I don't want to get on a tangent with him. But when he writes a story, used to be for Salon, now for Guardian, he'll put the links in there, right? But what I discovered, and I've written several times where I've taken his writings and kind of tore them apart, is if you go and read that link, doesn't really say what he says it does. You know, he'll use links as sources.
Mm-hmm. To show that I'm sourcing this.
And he may take one little sliver that was said in that piece, like the whole piece, you know, might point, have one kind of conclusion to it, but he'll pull out, you know, a sentence that says the opposite and use that as his.
I've had a few research papers that were kind of like that.
Really?
That's the idea, is that you just, like the source looks good on a student paper or in a piece of journalism if it's stated, but right. Whether or not you actually, who's going to go bother to check?
I know, and that's the thing is I, you know, and because I'm skeptical of him in general because he, you know, has, you know, for one thing, he's really hyperbolic, and he calls people. I mean, he's called me a baby that I support a baby killer.
You should be honored that he's calling you a baby.
Well, he wrote about me on Salon. You know, he gave me a lot of attention because of a couple of tweets I sent. But he's called me and Angry Black Lady, who you know I write for. He actually tweeted. Somebody tweeted that if she saw President Obama rape a nun on live TV, she would defend him or something like that.
Yeah.
And
crazy stuff.
And this guy tweeted that, and then Glenn Greenwald kind of added, no, she would say that he was something or other, you know. But he basically
bought in.
This rape, you know, this guy was saying, well, she'll support anything Obama does, even if he raped a nun on live TV. But, I mean, he kind of added to this guy's tweet and made it, went even further with it. So, I mean, he's very hyperbolic, and he calls people names, and he trashes journalists if they don't agree with him.
Yeah.
You know, he's just like, so anyways, I'm more skeptical of him. So when he puts a link there, I click on it, and then I'll start reading. I go, well, that doesn't say what he said. Wait a second. Or then within that one, there'll be another link, and you keep clicking, and you find out that his source wasn't even saying what he mm-hmm. wanted him to, and the tweets that got me in trouble because I was, you know, didn't sleep well or what, I don't know, I was ornery that day, but That was a. It was about drones and the number of people killed, you know, civilians killed by a certain drone strikes. And so I start clicking on his links to see the source, and one of them was a Taliban captain. That was the source of how many people were killed in that drone attack.
Those Taliban captains have a fine news organization.
Well, and they don't want to be.
And you can count them to be fair and balanced.
And they never put propaganda out, right?
No.
The Taliban, never. You know. So anyway,
strict controls.
I start digging, and I'm going, well, the source is kind of like the enemy or Al-Qaeda or, you know, it's like, and he's using that to argue against our government's numbers. Our government says, no, this is how many civilians were killed, and his source is the Taliban. So, you know, so I just kind of, I sent a hyperbolic tweet saying, you know, something kind of connecting him to terrorists, you know, mm-hmm. and it's like, and then he took that and
went crazy.
Yeah, went crazy with it and mischaracterized it and, see, they're calling me a terrorist. And I'm saying, no, I'm saying the source of your link was the Taliban. Now, I don't. If you want to call them a terrorist organization, you know, but I, you know, and of course, in 140 characters
on Twitter,
I was trying to be, you know, shitty.
Yeah, and you're also trying to say he was dishonest, and then he was actually trying to distort it into that you're calling him a terrorist.
Yeah, and then he lumped me in with, you know, anybody who speaks out against, you know, the U.S. government is, you know, helping the terrorists. You know, mm-hmm. it's like that's not what I was saying. I just. You know, and I sent a series of tweets saying, click through his links.
Right.
See where, you know, the sources for this number is a Taliban captain. Now, if you want to, you know, if he wants to say, this is the source, a Taliban captain, you decide whether you believe it or not. He didn't. He made a statement. He put a link there implying that he had a good source, which was a respectable organization. But then you click on that link, and then that story had a link to another source that was said it was a Taliban captain. So it was like two layers of links beyond, and the original source was the Taliban. And so, you know, and that's the thing with a lot of his writings is he'll put the links there, but I think he counts on people not clicking on them, because if they were, they would discover, well, that's not what you said it said. And it happens all the time with mm-hmm. his writing. So, you know, kind of segueing, and we're about to wrap up here, that social media, blogging, Twitter, Facebook, and what kind of impact that has on the immediacy of news, or, the, you know, now reporters are, they've got a tweet, they've got a Facebook post, they've got, you know, and everything's got to be quick, we got to be first. What impact is that having on the accuracy of media, do you think?
Well, that I think is what we're going to be talking about next time.
Right? Yeah, right. Whole another podcast.
I think what you're getting to in a nutshell is that the new technologies that we have and the changes that we have in our online connections can, on the dark side, create a web of lies, a web of misinformation, and web of deceit. Yeah, I mean, it can basically build upon itself where people make references or comments so that if you're consuming a good part of the information, you're either going to either not get the full story or just get misinformation. Mm-hmm. You know, that's, I think, a truth. But you're a practitioner of also the benefits of these changes, and that, you know, you can get a lot of information. It requires a much more sophisticated user, viewer, reader than ever before. We're not turning on Walter Cronkite at 6:30 anymore,
right.
And that's the way it is. It's a lot of different things coming from different places, and you have to really be able to figure out your sources. I think, you know, it means, I think we are informed. Sometimes we're informed too quickly. But there's probably not only, there's more energy being put into our media, and there's also more distortion going into the media. It's both, you know, there's a greater good that's happening, and there's a real unintended consequence mm-hmm. that's coming with it. And, you know, so it's, you know, both encouraging and discouraging at the same time.
That's well put.
Yeah. I guess the last thing I'll say, you know, before we wrap this up is, I think because of the media and the way you just described it so eloquently, it puts more pressure on our politicians, like President Obama, I was blown away when he the debt ceiling, the debt limit crisis or whatever, and he came out and he gave that press con. He gave a speech and then he took a press conference, and it was like he was talking to, you know, second graders. He was like, the debt ceiling is this, you know, these are all these, the Congress passed all these bills, now we have to pay for them. You know, I mean, he's
explaining it like he's talking
to, you know, second graders. And I think because the media hadn't done its job of explaining, you realize that, like, you know, Lindsey Graham says, well, we're not giving them a blank check, which isn't what the debt ceiling is about at all, because it isn't going to let him spend any more money. It's just paying the bills that the Congress has already passed. But I thought it was fascinating that the president came out and basically said, okay, well, I'm going to explain this so everybody can understand.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing was, like, the next day or 2 days later, several Republican politicians came out and said they weren't going to do it. And I was like, I think they might have been informed by the president, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think some of them really didn't know what the debt ceiling was based on what they were saying.
I think Clinton was perhaps our most expository president, explainer-in-chief. Obama can be great, but he doesn't always do it.
Yeah.
And when he does do it, and he's really clear, and you feel like, I'm not just sort of, you know, listening to him, but I'm learning from what he's saying.
Right.
That's what presidents have to do.
Yeah. And I think in today's modern media, I think they have to do it more. And the president needs to do that more often. Yeah. So, all right. Well, thanks for joining us, Keith.
Absolutely, Keith.
Another
this
great show.
This was great.
Thanks. What's the? When am I getting the check?
It's in the mail, buddy. It's in the mail.
It's already in the mail.
Great. Well,
no, we got to book the next guest appearance before we talk money.
Okay.
Well, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.